the end of the page. The end of the page is at 31A3.
Next week there will be no class. Next week there will be no class. I will, God willing, be in Jerusalem next week. The meeting of the Rabbinical Assembly. Conservative rabbis every once in a while get it right. And they did it this year. They're meeting in Jerusalem. So it's not like the other professions. Being married to a lawyer, they always get it right. It's always in California or Arizona, you know, one of those places like that. The rabbis, it's not our strength. Exactly. But once in a while. So next week. Okay, now we have been reading about the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, and the last thing we read about was the extraordinary behavior of a Roman, a pagan, a man named Dama ben Netina, who was several times brought up as the example of how to treat your parents. He was very, very kind to his mother, and we have read a number of incidents about him. Okay, now we're just finishing that up. I'll just do a little bit of review at the top of 31A3. Ki anta Rav Dimi Amar. When Rav Dimi came, he said, Rav Dimi, remember, was a person who traveled between Babylonia and the land of Israel. So when he would go back to Babylonia, he would tell the stories of the land of Israel, and he was one of the sources of halacha or of lore as it was in the land of Israel. So Ki Ata Rav Dimi means when Rav Dimi came back to Babylonia from the land of Israel, Pam Achat Aya Lavush, he told the story that one time Dama ben Netina, that's still continuing about Dama ben Netina, and of course he was a Roman, realized that in Babylonia you didn't have Romans. You had Babylonians and Persians in Babylonia. The land of Israel was a Roman province. So, Pam Achat Aya Lavush Sirkon Shel Zahav. Once Dama ben Netina was dressed in a coat that was of gold. Vaya Yoshev Ben Gedole Romi. And he was sitting among the nobles of Rome. Now, I don't think that means necessarily that he was in Rome, but that he, it may be that he was in Rome, or it may be that he was in Israel, in the land of Israel. And when it says Romi, Gedole Romi here, what it means is Romans. Because, as we've said before, there were many pockets in those days, in the first, second century, there were many pockets of Romans where the Romans lived, and the Romans sometimes lived very close to the Jews. But Gedole Romi could mean among Roman dignitaries in the land of Israel. Uvat Imo, his mother came, Ukrato Mimenu, and she ripped his coat off from him. Right, so it's a double loss. Number one, he has a gold coat. It's a very expensive thing, and the assumption here is that somebody wouldn't tear up their gold coat. And if anybody tore up their gold coat, they would be furious at them. So that doesn't happen. And number two, Vitafchalo al Rosho, she belts him on the head. She smashes him on the head, so she embarrasses him tremendously. Here he is, sitting in noble company, and his mother comes and embarrasses him. The Arkalo Bifanav, and she spit in his face. Sort of a weird story, but so it is. But the punchline is the last two words, Velo Hichlima, and he did not shame her. That is to say, he didn't have any reaction at all to his mother's behavior, and that was a sign of his extraordinary kibud av v'em. It's not necessarily to be understood that this is obligatory, this behavior, but it's commendable behavior. Exactly, it's commendable behavior, and again, it's interesting that it's in the story is about not about a Jew, but about a Gentile. So the Gentiles, according to the Talmud, were very scrupulous in their observance of the honor of their parents. And it's an interesting thing. I don't know how it is today, whether that's still the case. I don't think anybody takes care of their parents anymore. I'm not sure that Jews do either, by and large, as a community, with notable exceptions. But here you see the Gentiles are praised for what they did. Okay, we go on. Tani the Avdimi Berei the Rabbi Abau. Avimi, the son of Rabbi Abau, taught. This is a very important concept here. Yesh ma'achil aviv pisyoni. One can feed his father pisyon birds. Now let's just take a look at the Rashi there. Let's see, Rashi for pisyoni. Pretty sure there's a Rashi here.
Pisyoni.
Where is it? Oh yeah, pisyoni. Go over to the Rashi. Go on the left, the Hebrew page. Right side of that page, around the text, is the Rashi. It's up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the bottom of the Rashi. Pisyoni. Of chashuv. So of chashuv means an expensive bird. In other words, you're dealing with a very fine fowl. So a person can feed his father such fine fowl.
I think it's pheasant.
Could be pheasant. That's a good idea, right?
Right.
Chashuv, so it's of chashuv vishamein. Vishamein min slav she yarab minbar, like a quail that came down into the desert. Remember, it's in the Parsha about the quails coming down as a supplement, a dietary supplement to the manna. Okay, so in other words, this is very fine, a very fine bird, and by implication, it's expensive. So in other words, a son can feed his parent the most expensive food. Right? You would think it's a good thing. V'tordo min ha'olam, and drive his parent out of the world. In other words, it can be done. It's not the amount of money that you spend, but it's how you actually deliver the service. V'yesh matchino berechayim, and there is another person who can make his father grind with a millstone, u'mivio l'chayei olam haba, and bring him into the next world. In other words, it can be a beautiful thing in a certain case if you make your father grind with a millstone. Now, let's take a look here at the Tosafot. Beck, we're still on 31 without turning the page. The last Tosafot on the page. Now remember, Tosafot is on the opposite side of the page from where the Rashi is. It's the last Tosafot. Tordo min ha'olam. Perush en nashalav. That's to say, he's punished for what he does to his parent. Shemare lo tsar ayin. Because he shows him a narrow look. In other words, he's very narrow-minded, narrow toward his parent. Also, udato, concerning the meal, v'yesh matchino berechayim, and there is somebody else who causes his father to mill with a millstone, shehi malacha kasha, which is difficult labor, u'mivio l'chaye olam haba, and mivio, that is to say, the son, inherits eternity. The son inherits eternity. That's to say, he does such a good thing for his father. Well, on the surface, it seems hard to imagine this. U'mechabdo bidvarim, here it goes on, ha'olam haba. Shemechabdo bidvarim tovim. For he honors him with good words. It's the way you say it, and how you mean it, that counts. Tovim v'nichumim, comforting words. He says things to his father in a comforting fashion. Ubirat Yerushalmi, and in the Talmud Yerushalmi, Garsinin, we read the following. Maaseh bishnehem, a story that concerns both these people. That is to say, the man who feeds his father the pisyoni, and the man who causes his father to work the millstone. One man used to feed his father pheasants. Bamachat amar lo aviv. Once his father said to him, Me'ayin lecha kol ele. How is it that you have all of these things? It's very expensive, you know. How is it that you have so much money to feed me like this? Amar lo saba, mai ichpat lach. He says to him, old man, what difference does it make to you? Additchon v'achol. Just go and eat. Just chew your food. Not a nice way to talk to your father. I'd say you can give your father the best food, but when you talk to him in a crude fashion, you've hurt him. And that's terrible. Okay, so it doesn't really matter what the amount of money that's involved. The choklomar laos vechol. Chew your food and eat. Ke'en klavim. Like dogs. Like a dog. Okay? So it was treating his father like a dog. You know, that's that. What?
Feed him and walk
him. Feed him and walk him, exactly. The machin v'ochlim. Im came herahu shekashelav. He showed, he revealed to his father that his father was difficult to tolerate. Right? He was impatient with his father. And he readily revealed his impatience with his father, and didn't matter how much money he was spending. V'shuv ma'aseh b'echad sh'aya tochen b'rechayim. There is another story about somebody who put a millstone to grind in a mill. Ve'av zaken hayavo, and he had an old father. Ve'ata tzivui letochanim, and there came a command from the king to those who were grinders. Perush mitzvata melech, that is to say, a command from the king, bishvil aviv, for his father. So his father was going to get drafted into the king's service. Lavo la'avodat ha-melech, to come to be drafted into the king's service. Amar le beno, the son says to the father, tchon v'ani elech tachtecha, you grind the millstone and I'll go into the king's service. Okay? La'avodat ha-melech, she'en la kitzba, because there is no end to the king's service. That is to say, it would kill his father, because the amount of labor that would be required was simply without any end. So it's better, he said, look, let me do the hard work, and you'll do the relatively easy work. So it doesn't matter what you do, but how you do it. It's all the thought behind it and the way you convey it, and the respect that is conveyed in the actions and in the words.
There's a quote by, I forgot the author, but it goes something like, people will forget what you do, and people will forget what you say, but people never forget how you make them feel.
That's it. Very good. And if that's generally true, how much more so as far as the parent? And it's very difficult. It's not so simple with a parent. I don't have to tell any of you. Those relationships are the most complex. They are the most complex. Normal behavior, the normal person has a certain amount of anger, usually somewhere in there. And these are hard relationships. And the parents can also be, can be difficult. They can be very difficult, partly because they're parents, partly because they're old, partly because they are who they are. And it can be very, very difficult. And as you'll see, the Talmud will eventually say, the Talmud is going to reflect on that point. Okay?
Yes. I question whether it's better to do what's right, or to just make somebody feel good.
Well, what is right? What do you mean by right?
Well, okay, in the long run, if you do what you think is right, okay, let's take an example of putting someone in an old age home. A parent.
We'll get to that.
Or is it the right thing or the wrong thing in
the long run? Let's hold on a little bit to that, because that's a more extreme case. This is not the extreme case. But there are all kinds of cases. There are extreme cases where we will have to wonder, what do you do in when things get to be really bad? Let's say, when you are hurting very much. That's one kind of extreme case. Nobody wants to go to a home? I'm not sure about that. Yes, nobody wants to go, but most of my experiences are that when people do do this, if they do it in a loving family, everybody understands that it's the best thing for everybody involved. If you have, if you're dealing with a parent who is against it, then God help you if you do it, because it's not necessarily the right thing to do. If the parent is has lost, is insane, that's another case. That's a case where judgment, you cannot, you have to really deal with someone who has no judgment. That's a special case, and we'll get to that case. But I don't think that that's to be assumed here at all. I think to be assumed here is just the notion that people will frequently think that it's how much you spend that's all that counts. The point here is that it's not the amount of money that you spend. It has to do with the attitude that you convey when you are, in fact, delivering the service.
You think you could look at these examples as not exactly parables, but perhaps something to aspire to.
Exactly.
Even the most devoted son or daughter sometimes reaches their limit, has a bad day, on both sides, perhaps. And it's instructive because it touches a mirror, or it touches a conscience somewhere. But I mean, I think it would be, it strikes me, it would be a misinterpretation to say, if you didn't do this all the time, if you had an occasion, even, where you said, look, what's the difference? That's just that. That's not the end of the world. It's just that you should keep in mind.
Correct. And I think that's the function of these stories, actually. Yeah. These are to provide examples of things for which one might strive. Realize that at no point now, we still have not gotten to any details about what the mitzvah means. So far we're seeing it simply used as an, almost as a metaphor. We're seeing it in general terms about relationships. We're seeing the importance of what you convey, the feelings that are being conveyed. But in truth, all of this is preparatory to what the mitzvah actually is, and we haven't even seen that yet. So a lot of this, I think, these are stories to aspire to. These are stories about people that should make you want to ideally be like at least some of them, right? Even though we can't really say that this is obligatory behavior.
I think that for the child it's extremely important whether the parent is a surviving parent or a member of a couple.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it, because the role that you'll play will be quite different. I think all of us who have had two old parents than one old parent know that your job changes. But you have a very different role to play once the spousal role doesn't exist anymore. And it's very different, you're right. Okay, let's keep going. Look at this story that you'll now read. Now, keep in mind the people. Just keep it, this last thing that we read about the pheasants, right? This was Avimi, the son of Rabbi Abahu, taught this. Avimi, so Abahu is the father, Avimi is the son. Keep that in mind for this next story. Amar Rabbi Abahu, said Rabbi Abahu, Kagon, that is to say, honoring one's father. I want to tell you a story about my son. And he's praising his son for the way in which he honored his father. And this Avimi was the one who told the previous story, so he's obviously, this is something that's very important to him. Avimi Bri Kiyem Mitzvat Kibud. Look at the way my son Avimi observed the mitzvah of honoring one's father. Chamisha Bane Samche Havale LeAvimi B'Chaye Aviv. Avimi had five ordained sons during his father's life. V'chi Hava Ater Rabbi Abau Kare Ababa. When Rabbi Abau came calling at the door, at the gate, Rahid Va'azil, his son, ran and came and opened it for him himself. I'm going to go to the end here and then give you an explanation. Right, Patachle. Va'amar, and he said on the way to opening the door for his father, in adamatai atam. Yes, I shall open it. Yes, I shall open it. Don't worry, I'm coming, I'm coming, I'm coming. He ran to open the door for his father. Yom Achad Amar Le Ashkiyan Maya. One day Rabbi Abau told Avimi, get us water to drink. Ad Da'ait Le Nimneim. By the time Avimi brought the water, Rabbi Abau had fallen asleep. Gachin Kai Ale Ad It'ar. He leaned over, Avimi leaned over, and waited for his father to wake up. Istaya Milta Vidarash Avimi Mizmor La'asaf. Apparently the time that he spent was worthwhile because he was able to give an explanation to a biblical verse that was otherwise very difficult. God rewarded him, in other words, for his good deeds. Okay. Now, a word about the story, the first part of the story. Avimi has, Rabbi Abau is, as it were, the grandfather, has a son, Avimi. Avimi has five sons. Avimi's five sons are all rabbis, which is to say, they're ordained rabbis, right? Which is to say that they knew about the mitzvah of honoring. Okay? On the one hand. On the other hand, I think that what is being implied by this story is that, and I'm sure that some of you have seen this, grandchildren tend to run to the door faster than your own children. Okay? You know, when you're going to visit, or they're coming to visit you, the most excited ones tend to be the grandchildren, as opposed to your own children. Again, your own children have more complicated relations with you. Grandchildren actually have simpler relations. You know about those things. So, in this case,
you know, the gifts are coming
for a lot of things. Right? It's all good. You know, it's all the good stuff. All the good, none of the bad. Right? So, in this case, I think the assumption is, on two levels, that the grandchildren, first of all, because they're grandchildren, would have been the ones who would get to the door first. Secondly, they're rabbis. So that there's an overlay of obligation here, that they would realize, you know, that this is the right thing to do. And who wears the Nikes to get to the door first? Avimi the son. Right? That's, I think, the way the story is constructed, to say that this son outran his own children to pay honor to his father. It would have been natural for the children to really outrun him, but he ran so fast that he outran his own children. Okay? Any questions or comments here? Yes?
So, from what you're reading so far, I gather that the objective of honoring your father is to make him feel good.
Correct. That is, at least as far as these stories go. Again, we haven't seen a lot of concrete stuff, but you've seen it in general terms. It's to feel good is a little bit too dismissive, because we talk about feel good, you know, as something that's not important. Feel good to indicate honor, respect, to, as I say it elsewhere, to put a person on a pedestal. When somebody knows they're being treated very well, that's more than feeling good. They're put on a pedestal. And parents really want to be on a pedestal. You really want to, because you don't necessarily get that kind of treatment. A lot of the opposite. And when every once in a while you're treated with honor, it goes a long way. It goes a long way. And that's not to say that it's a natural thing for a child to do. That's why this kind of behavior is mandated behavior. It's a behavior that's part of the mitzvah, whether it's natural or not to do that.
If a father has a strong ego and wants to be on the pedestal all the time,
mm-hmm.
and the kid is a little bit shy kid, wants to respect his father, mm-hmm. but cannot serve him it as such, mm-hmm. just to let him feel good.
Mm-hmm. The father is not allowed to abuse the privilege. It could be
but
that...
But how it's been translated between the relations? I mean, so who is protected in this case?
Sometimes you have to protect the child. A parent can be abusive of a child. A parent can use anything to abuse a child. Among the things are honor. A parent can embarrass a child to deliver types of honor. So it's not simple. It's not simple. And if you have the case of the parent who is unduly taking advantage of that, then sometimes the child has to defend himself. Because you do not have to kill yourself for a parent, as I think will become obvious in a little bit. Okay? Yes?
I think this reminds me of what we learned a few weeks ago, which is that this mitzvah has a parallel in the way we are to interact with God.
That's right.
And it's really very striking here, that v'ahavta et Hashem elokecha. So, it isn't enough, for example, to say in a rote way prayers. I mean, it's better than nothing. But more important is the way you feel, or the way you are communicating that, in the case of prayer, to God. Here, it's similar. It's not enough to do the thing. You should have kavanah. You should have real feeling for it, and accompany it with a sense of love.
Very good. Very good. Very good.
Can I go back to earlier? In the case of the Roman.
Of the what? The Roman? Dama ben Atina?
Yeah. Who was meeting with some dignitaries. Is it important what motivated his mother to behave in this way? It's just a literary device? Or was she perhaps felt less honored? Earlier they said he showed great respect to his father.
Well, I think it's a good point. I think that as far as the story is concerned, yes, it is a literary device, because in a way it doesn't matter what the reason was, because we're not told. We're not really given any indication of what the reason was at all. And instead, all we have to wonder about that. And I think as a literary device, that's actually quite effective. To tell us less is actually more helpful in the circumstances, because we can't say, oh, this is a case of, or this is a case of this or that or another thing. We have no idea. All we know is that he was extremely embarrassed by the situation, and that he was able to control himself. And that was an indication of his respect. Okay. Let's keep going. Amar le Rav Yaakov bar Avuha la Abaya. Rav Yaakov bar Avuha says to Abaya, Kagon Ana, da'ad atina mibei Rav, such as my own situation. Now, such as, that is to say, he's going to bring us a case now, which is a little bit different. And he's interested in the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, and in his own case, it was a little bit odd. Kagon Ana, da'ad da'atina mibei Rav, whenever I would come home from the study hall, Abba madle likasa ve'ima mazgali, My father would prepare a cup of water for me, and my mother would mix the wine for me. In other words, the strange thing here is that they honored him. They honored him. And the question is that wrong? Because if you're supposed to honor them, what about the situation where they end up honoring you? I see this every once in a while, actually, in the context, in our own context, because so frequently, at least children of our generation, I don't know if it's true of our children, but children of our generation have levels of education and status that their parents didn't have. And their parents invested themselves enormously to achieve that. And the weird thing is that the parents actually respect that status that they, in a way, have provided for their child. And it, I've seen peers of my age and your age embarrassed by that, not knowing to how to react to their parent, because their parents are being too nice to them. Their parents really have created something that they always wanted. You know, the well-educated, well-placed, well-earning person, they never had any of those things, but they were sure that they were going to produce it. And then the child, sometimes in a quandary, do I allow them to make me feel this good? It just doesn't seem right. It's not right. Okay? So this is the position that Rav Yaakov Bar Avuha is in. Okay? Hechi Evid, he says to the rabbi, what should I do? What should I do here? Amar Le, Abaya answers him, Me'imach Kabel. From your mother, take it. Don't say anything. Me'avuch lo tekabel. But from your father, don't take it. Dekevan devar Torah. Look at the reason. Because he will have studied the Torah, chal shadate, at some point he'll get upset about it. So in other words, if there is likelihood that that at some point this will turn into a parent's resentment, and in this case he felt that that would be the case, then you shouldn't do it. You should just step back as far as the father is concerned. Assuming that that would not be the case for the mother, then that just doesn't enter into the picture. In fact, halacha is along these lines, and halacha is just responsive to the facts on the ground. The halacha is whatever is the most appropriate thing. In other words, if it makes the parent feel good to fuss over the child, father or mother, in fact, yes, if the father is a type that will eventually regret it, okay, then you don't do it. Then you put it off. But if, in fact, you are convinced of the fact that even the father really gets pride and enjoyment out of this, let it go on. Let it go on.
So I think that's really the distinction. I think parents can be proud of their children, but when you morph over into honoring them, that's where the line is transgressed. And I think that the... honoring the children. And I think we actually see this played out on the political scene in our own country all the time. We have expectations about... we now have parents of presidents. And there's a lot of the public's fascination with that relationship and whether they treat them... with pride in what they do, or whether or not they are moving over into that sense of awe of them. And this constant fascination whether that relationship is a healthy one.
That's interesting, because I remember reading before the inauguration that Mrs. Obama's mother was going to move into the White House. I assume that happened. I haven't read anything about it since. And... must have been an article in the Times or somewhere else, and that just recounted that this was not the first time that had been done before, and that Harry Truman's mother-in-law lived in the White House, and she gave him a very hard time.
She was not good enough for her daughter.
Correct. I mean, it didn't matter that he was president. My daughter married this haberdasher.
Right.
You know, what did I need this for? and she never let Eric Schulman forget it. So my sense was of Obama's mother-in-law that she's also a tough cookie.
Oh, yeah.
She's a tough cookie and probably was not going to let him get off easy, president and all that. But these women were really, they were people to deal with. Right.
In this case, it wasn't only that the man was his father, but that it was his father who may have been a Torah scholar that would have...
Correct.
Which is interesting. I mean, being the father alone, you don't assume that he would be upset that the son was accepting wine from him. He had to be a scholar also.
Because the assumption here, I think, in the story is because it would be the reflection on the nature of the mitzvah itself, that there is such a mitzvah, and that the father, even though he was enjoying the role that he was playing, would feel that he was doing something wrong, because he was aware of the mitzvah. So he would end up, even though what was natural to him was to enjoy what he was going to do, as when he was reflecting on it.
The fact that he was a scholar gave him knowledge of what the relationship should have been.
Correct. And that he was somehow, he knew what the mitzvah was, mm-hmm. and the child was to honor him, and he ended up in a conflict because mm-hmm. of that.
It's also a commentary on maternal role, because if you think about it in this context, a lot of things that are instinctive maternal actions and reactions can be interpreted as an outsider as honoring,
mm-hmm.
Because the instinct of the mother to feed,
mm-hmm. right.
You know,
it's true.
If you see that as serving, because you see it through those eyes, that looks like it's honoring, but in fact, it's impossible to no, just by looking
sure.
at it,
sure.
whether it's simply the maternal instinct.
The interesting thing, in addition to that, would now be where you have women who are Torah scholars, which you have in our time. The level of knowledge among women about these things, in all of your cases, I would bet that all of the women here, probably you have read more Talmud than your mothers have. you know, they may be very well educated, but I suspect that probably you've read more Talmud than your mothers have. You know, you're therefore in a somewhat different position. So, and if this is natural, it creates a conflict. If it was a conflict for a man, it would probably even more of a conflict for a woman. Maybe. Or maybe less, I don't know. Maybe if a woman it would be easier for her to say, oh, don't be stupid. You know, this is just natural. You know, that's the way we do these things. We don't have to be so thoughtful. Good. Okay, we go on. Rabbi Tarfon, Havalei Hai Ima. Rabbi Tarfon had a mother. And the commentators say that she was an elderly mother. V'chol Emata Hava Baya, whenever she wanted lemesat lepuria to go up into the bed, gachim v'salikla, he would bend down, and she would climb on him. So she must have had a high bed, and he was the step for her to get onto the bed. Right? It was hard for her to get herself up into the bed, and he used his own back to make a step for her. V'chol ema tahava nachit, whenever she would get out of bed, ata v'ka mishtach be midrasha. No, I jumped a line. Nachat alei, elave. She would come down stepping on him. Ata v'ka mishtabach be midrasha. Rabbi, apparently, the understanding is here that Rabbi Tarfon came and spoke about his own behavior. I'm not sure that that's true, because it could be that somebody else came and spoke about his behavior, that it was simply known that he did these things. Amrei le'adayin lo higat l'chatzi kibud. Or, well, probably the former is more likely here. And they said to him, the students, you haven't even done half of what you should be doing. In other words, he was proud of himself. But they said to him, you haven't even done anything. All right, then they go on. Klum zarka arniki b'fanecha leyam v'lo ichlamta. Has your mother ever thrown a bag of money into the sea in your presence and you did not shame her? In other words, she could really upset you. You know, and it's nice to do the things that are really not so hard. But every once in a while, she may do something that really gets your goat. Has she done that yet? You know, so don't think you're such a big shot. Don't think you're such a big shot.
Like I said, psychiatrists would have a ball with the story. Of course, if he really wanted to honor her, he could have made her a step stool and not been her step stool.
So I told this story once with Sam Claxburn present. And Sam said, that's an example. He should have gone to a psychiatrist.
Dog step.
Okay, we go on. Now, look at this next story. This next story is a fascinating one. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. I'm still skipping. All right, let's finish up with Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef, ki hava shama kal kare de'ime. Oh, that's a great one. It's a beautiful story. When Rav Yosef heard the footsteps of his mother, Amar, ikum mikamesh chinte da'atya. Let us get up before the Holy Presence who is coming near.
Oh,
it's just an extraordinary story.
Didn't she say?
No, I don't think so.
That's
I think
the president gets in.
No, I think that goes back to what Dan said before. The honor of the parent is reflective of honor of God. Mm-hmm. And he had so much respect for his mother, so much love for his mother, and she was so noble to him in his eyes, that he spoke of his mother's presence as God's presence. When he heard his mother coming, he said, God is coming. God is coming.
Shechinah.
And the Shechinah is indicative of the feminine side of the divine presence. Correct. It's God's love. When his mother came, God's love came. And he was aware of that. More than once, I have used this story for a eulogy. Because every once in a while, someone tells me, and I don't necessarily know the deceased, but I sit with him and I just see that a person's mother was the world. That they begin to talk about their mothers, and you see, it's just an extraordinary, it's such a beautiful thing when they speak about their mothers. Such devotion, such admiration. And since I don't know the person per se, I'm looking for some way to put it, and I use this story.
But when children are very little, this is how they feel about the mother.
I hope.
I mean, then when they're like 2 and 3. You know, I mean, I'm just thinking of my own niece.
Uh-huh.
You know, she screams with delight when she sees her mother.
Well, it's nice if you're a parent and you can remember some of those things, too. Because they're very precious when they happen.
You know, we have families in the congregation who it relates to the father. Well, not necessarily, but I mean, I've seen it when the father has an aliyah and the family stands during the aliyah.
That's an interesting thing. That is the custom in the Spanish Portuguese synagogue, for example. Any of you ever daven on the west side, West 70th Street in Central Park West? Whenever a man has an aliyah, the entire family stands. The entire family, the women stand, the men stand, as an honor to the father. And I've seen it done a little bit in Israel among Ashkenazim, who have picked it up from the Sfardim. It's a very beautiful custom. It's a very beautiful custom.
It's so sweet. It's the two twin plus
the Hawa.
Oh, the Hawa. Hawa, because they're Sfardim.
Yeah.
They're Sfardim, and they learn that from their parents. They learn that from their parents, and it's such a sweet thing to see. It's a very sweet thing to see. So some of these customs, you know, there's room to to bring them back and to spread them. Very nice. Okay, now look at this next story. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, Ashrei mi shelo chama'an. Happy is the person who never saw his parents. It breaks your heart to hear this. And let's go on. Rabbi Yochanan, ki ibarto imo met aviv. When Rabbi Yochanan's mother had conceived, was carrying him, his father died. Yeladato meta imo. When she gave birth, she died. She died in childbirth. The chen abaya. And so was the case for abaya also. So, such a moving story here. Rabbi Yochanan was one of the greatest rabbis in the Talmud. Really, the Jerusalem Talmud is attributed to Rabbi Yochanan. He was the key figure as the transitional figure between the period of the Tanaim and the Amoraim. Was somebody who was much a part of the Roman world, was well aware of the Roman world, and was really trying to provide a Jewish sort of the Jewish context for the Roman world. And Rabbi Yochanan, we have many stories about him, and there's a certain pathos to the stories of Rabbi Yochanan. There's a story about he lost a whole bunch of children, and the Talmud tells us about his loss of his own children, and there too it breaks your heart. And now you see that he was an orphan. He grew up as an orphan. And in teaching and studying the material of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, one of the possible reactions are, who could ever do this? Who could ever do this? So he says about himself, blessed am I that I never had to worry about problems like this. But frankly, for the reader, I find it hard to read this without getting choked up. That he should respond, you know, in his own way. And of course it makes sense what he's saying, but it doesn't make sense at all. It's just so sad. It's incredibly sad. And he's seeing it from the good side. And it's seeing it really from the good side that in a way makes it so terrible. That he was without parents his entire life. And Abaya, one of the other great figures of the Talmud. Abaya also, exactly the same position. The Talmud asks immediately about this example of Abaya. It says, Eini, is it so for Abaya? Ha'amar Abaya Amri Le'im. He says, Abaya said, my mother said to me. So he says this in the Talmud. He quotes his mother. Ha'hi Marbin Peha. Havai. That was his nurse. In fact, that's the story of Abaya. Abaya became very close to this woman who was his nurse, and she was his mother. She was, in effect, an adoptive mother, but his own mother died, in all likelihood, in childbirth. So here you see there's at least a moment of reflection on the impossibility of these mitzvot. That they are so hard and so weighty that somebody of the standing of Rabbi Yochanan says, you know, lucky is he who doesn't have to, who never saw his parents.
Does this discussion ever get to the point of, is there an understanding that this respect is extended to whomever raises you if you're not raised by your biological parents, or does it?
Yeah, in later literature, certainly, it stands to reason. It's not the mitzvah of the Torah, because the Torah is really concerned about the biological parents. But it stands to reason, and we have this, particularly in the modern world, the concept of adoption, for example, is, as a legal category, is a very recent idea. We have no concept in Jewish law of adoption. it has come into Jewish law in the last 60 years or so, just as recently as that. And there's been a just sort of about 40 years ago, there was a great deal written 30 years ago on the subject of adoption, because it was new and it began to be an issue in the Jewish community. And things like this were sort of brought into that context. And there's a lot of very interesting law, but it's very modern law having to do with adoption.
Didn't the story of Jacob adopting Joseph, adopting is the wrong word, but he, Jacob, adopts the children of,
right, yeah, as it were. Right.
So is that, I guess because it's still biological, it's not really adoption?
There it's a question probably of inheritance. What it means is that Joseph ends up getting the double portion the way the firstborn would have gotten. Firstborn would have had a double portion. Now Joseph ends up also with a double portion as a result of that. I think that's probably the force of it, the circumstance.
I find it strange that there's not an older history of adoption in the Jewish community. It was very common in the ancient world. It was very, very common in the Roman world.
Well, that I can't say, but in the Jewish world, it was not. It was the family took care. The family took care. The assumption is, until very, very recently, that you're born not into a nuclear family, but you're born into a larger family.
Right.
You're born into, and the family takes care. It could be a sister, somebody steps in. The concept that a stranger would step in was not, nobody could imagine that. It just was not imaginable. That you have agencies dealing with these things, for unknown people, that's an indication of a total transformation in the nature of the family. And that's a relatively recent phenomenon.
My mother-in-law, Aaron's mother, lost both her parents when she was about a year old. And she was raised by grandmothers and then by her sisters.
That's how it was done.
Rav Lau, after the war, Rav Lau was adopted by his greater family when he was brought as a child to Israel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not legal adoption. I mean,
It's not nothing. The legal side was irrelevant in a way. It was just this was obvious that these are the things that you did, and that's the way people dealt with these circumstances. And they were not rare, because the death was far more normal in pre-modern times than it is today. So today is the odd situation as far as as history goes.
When I was growing up, there was something called the Pride of Judea that was for orphans, and it was a Jewish home for kids.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some kind of other...
Yeah, you did have really, the beginning of the 20th century, you began to have orphanages. Part of it was the result of immigration.
Of the war, immigration, yeah.
It was immigration. That you would have families just weren't what they used to be. And, the many tentacled family stopped existing once you had massive immigration. So that, in fact, the community had to begin to set up institutions in the community to take care of needy children. Right, that was the way it was done at that time. Correct. That was the way it was done.
And my grandfather lost his father when he was very young, and he was the eldest son, and his mother felt that she couldn't take care of three children. She couldn't take care of two.
Right.
And she put him in an orphanage. This was in Kishinev, I guess early 1900s or even before then.
Interesting.
And he was grateful that happened because he got an education.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Jewish orphanage. He got an education that he might otherwise not have had had she not put him in that.
Sure, it's fascinating. Dan, what are you going to say?
We read about obligations of the kehillah for poor people, but is there halacha about what obligations, if any, there are on family members and
family. Yes. Yeah. The question is a question of charity, whether it begins at home. So, and in fact, the law is that charity begins at home, and that you have to take care of your family first, and then you take care of the people in the community. So, I mean, we could get more detailed than that, but that's the general idea. Yeah.
Okay. What is the rabbinic attitude towards the contemporary phenomenon of adoptive children wanting to find their birth parents, and what are the obligations of the birth parents if the children and the birth parents are reunited in this context?
It's not simple. There's much discussion on this today because of the tendency in Judaism to regard biological parentage as permanent, and that has an independent value of and by itself. It's not only the parents who bring you up, but there is a value to the biological parent. So that we tend to be more sympathetic with that than some of the stuff that's out there. But it's not simple. You know, there are arguments on both sides for these things. And you're concerned about all those things.
Okay. A social question. One source of children for adoption were births out of wedlock. Maybe the main source. Poverty and today, being a single parent, it's fairly routine in our society. What happened, God forbids, that should have happened in a Jewish family? I'm not talking about in the last few decades, did the family still take in the child, or did they send the mother and the child?
I don't really know the answer to that. I can only tell you what I've actually experienced myself, just living in this neighborhood. And being a rabbi here, I'm a rabbi in this neighborhood since the 70s, and I can just tell you in that little slice of life, one indicator that might be relevant in thinking this out, and that is the history of the Louise Wise Adoption Agency. Any of you know what Louise Wise Adoption Agency is? Louise Wise Adoption Agency was founded by the Federation. Well, Louise Wise was one of the daughters, I believe, of Rabbi Stephen Wise. So you're dealing here with people who are very prominent in Jewish community life. And there was a Louise Wise agency which was for Jewish adoption. Now, there could be two reasons why there would be Jewish adoption: death of parents or out of wedlock babies.
I'm really thinking maybe even in Talmudic times, but let's say 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
I don't know the answer to that. I have no idea. I do not know. I'm just going to say, in this case of Louise Wise Agency, during the years that I've been a rabbi on the Upper East Side, that agency began to change. I remember I had a congregant once who was president of the agency, and he came to me and he said, "We want to make the agency become a black agency, no longer a Jewish agency. Would it be right for the Jewish community to continue to support it?" So we discussed that. That's an interesting question. The reason was there simply were no Jewish babies. There were no Jewish babies anymore. There were Jews who wanted to adopt, but there were no Jewish babies. And the number of Jewish babies began to fall off more and more and more as a result of birth control. And the availability of birth control in a rather knowledgeable piece of the community, which is the Jewish community. Finally, so they did that for a while. Finally, what happened is that Louise Wise Agency plain went out of business. And they sold the building, which is up on 94th Street, is it? It's between Madison and Park. It's a gorgeous building. Just gorgeous building. The early days of Or Zarua, we looked at that building, hoping that we could buy
it.
It became...
It was maternal, it was...
I'm not referring to the building that was where the
The expensive building is at 93rd. It was a like a rehab place before Spence just bought it. Beautiful building.
It may have been Spence.
North side of the street?
It's on the south side of the street.
South side of the street.
It's a very beautiful, large building. A limestone building. That's probably the building.
Turned into a rehab
I think a drug rehab. It was drug rehab or something like that.
Wasn't Planned Parenthood, but it was...
Down a block or so. Was eventually bought by, what's his name, the actor, Woody Allen. That's where Woody Allen... Woody Allen lived there.
That's 92nd.
That's 92nd Street, right. This was, I think, a block up or so. But anyway...
That's 93rd.
The Louise Wise Agency is history. Simply a piece of the history of this neighborhood. And... I've been around long enough that even in my short life that I saw that happen. So these things change over time.
The discussion reminds me of the old aspect in Japanese culture, which dictates that if people have children, should have daughters first, so that the daughters can take care of the little boys.
Of little boys. In traditional societies till today,
it's supposed to happen.
I mean, if you want to see societies where these things are functioning, go to a place like Japan, where honor of parents is still very sacred in the society, and they live by that. And it's extraordinary. It's an extremely moving thing to see how these societies actually function. Our society is a little bit out of kilter in terms of the centrality of this. We have a lot of other forces that work in our society. But some of the traditional societies like Japan are still very powerful mitzvah like this.
Another profound difference that that I've observed is in Indian culture, where when the son marries the daughter, no longer has any obligations to her own parents. She now has all of her obligations to her husband's parents. And if you actually play this out in your mind, you can understand a whole lot about the structure of that culture as a result of this phenomenon. This is such a defining event, and it so conditions the perception of the value of her daughter. Because knowing that that daughter will not be there to take care of you in your old age.
Right. You've got to have sons who have wives who will take care of you.
Right. But I'm just saying, we take for granted the honoring the father and the mother, and by all children having that obligation. But if you think of a society where you tear that asunder...
Right. That's very interesting. You're right.
Yeah, we just studied 2 weeks ago that Jewish women who are married have obligations to the parents.
That's also true. Correct. Correct. It's not as extreme as it is what Barry is saying, but yes, you're right.
I just want to say one more thing in terms of traditional. Several years ago, Barry was. We went to an Arab family, an Arab home, where they entertained us, which is bringing in lots and lots of food because Barry had done. Some work, with medicine with this family. And when the grandfather came in, no one was allowed to sit in his chair. And everybody stood up for the grandfather in the family. And he had his own special chair that no one, there were several generations there, was allowed to sit at.
That's true.
So there was a great deal of attention to the respect for this patriarch in the family.
It actually was. It was a richer story in the sense that someone sat down in that chair at the beginning, and then someone came in. It was obviously of higher, age rank, and that person got out of that chair immediately and escorted the person. And then this went for I think at least two additional rounds as the elders came in. And you saw the hierarchy was, this chair defined the hierarchy. You didn't need any scorecard. You knew who was who, just based on this chair.
I think it's really very important. Because we Jews, we're living in a time right now when we find it very difficult to relate to Arabs. But those of you who have had the experience... It's awesome to see the way some of these families function. I know I've had relations with Arabs in Israel, and it's just beautiful. The status of parents in the Arab family, amazing. I remember having once, I could take my life in my hands, but I had these Arab guys to breakfast. And they, sweet fellows, before the Intifada, and they came in and I served them breakfast and talked about, you know, what it was like in their town, their village, their kfar. They live out near Tekoa in Judea. And they said, well, you know, we work and our father doesn't. And there must have been, I don't know, 10 children or 12 children, something like that. And they all support their parents. So I said, well, how old are you? How old are your elderly parents? And they were, I don't know, 45 or something like that, the parents, you know. some very young age, and they were retired. They were not allowed to do any work because it would have been embarrassing to the community. If a parent would still work when he has children who could support him, that was a shanda. And you would lose all your status in the community if that were to happen. So, so the difference between Jewish life and the Arab life is very obvious to me, but I must say that I thought it was awesome. It was just amazing people.
That's more of a tribal tradition than a religious one.
Whatever it is, it's the way they live.
Don't we have a tradition of respect in terms of standing up?
Yeah, we'll get to that in detail. Yes, that's exactly what you're going to read probably next time. Okay? Let's go on. Very interesting incident is now going to be described. Rav Asi Havelehai Imazakena. Rav Asi had an elderly mother. Amra le be'ina tachshitin. She said to him, I want jewelry. Avadla. He made jewelry for her. Be'ina gavra. I want a husband. Nayin lach. I will look for one for you. Ba'ina gavre de shapir kavatach. I want a husband as handsome as you are. And I think here the sense is that there are borders that the woman was transgressing. There are levels of propriety that she is transgressing here, and the assumption is that she was demented.
That she was what?
Demented. That she was demented. All right, look what he says. Ba'ina gavre de shapir kavatach. Shavka va'azal la'ara de Yisrael. He left her and went to the land of Israel. He realized, in light of everything that we've seen, that should seem unthinkable. If you are so required to pay respect and honor to the parent, here he responds by leaving town, leaving the country. Basically, he can't take it. She is putting him into a position that he can't deal with it himself. And so he goes to the land of Israel. Shama de ka'azla batrei. He hears that she's coming after him. She has no muzzle, this poor guy. He runs away from his mother, and she comes running after him. Ata lakame de Rabbi Yochanan. Amar lei, he came before Rabbi Yochanan and asked him, Mahu latzeit me'aretz lechutza la'aretz? What is the law? May one leave the land of Israel and go abroad? Amar lei asur. You're not allowed to go abroad. Likrat ima mau. If you're living in the land of Israel, many of the rabbis teach that you're not allowed to leave. Not allowed to leave. Because you can leave and stay. So that's not good. You should live in the land of Israel. So the question is, what, he says, well, what if the reason that I want to leave is to honor my mother?
To honor her?
To honor her. Okay?
Was that like a trick question he was asking?
Well, we don't know. We don't know whether it is.
The same Bible.
We don't know, because she's coming after him, because he doesn't want to go, So I would imagine that what he is trying to do, to the extent that it's a trick question, is to get a no answer. Because he certainly doesn't want to go out after her. On the other hand, he's a rabbi in the land of Israel. He has to do the right thing. And whatever the right thing is will, of course, take precedence. So his mother is coming. It's not as if he can run away from this thing. So he asks the rabbi so that, in fact, he'll do what's right.
But could it be that she's coming and she'll be in the land of Israel? She won't leave and he's stuck and so with her there.
Maybe. We'll see how it turns out.
Sorry, he wants to know what he
does. Okay.
Yeah.
In order to go to meet my mother, what is the law? Amale, listen to the answer to this. Eni yodea. I don't know what the law is. Which is, every once in a while when you see that in the Talmud, it's hard to believe that he means it. In other words, don't ask.
Don't ask.
You know, this is one of those things where you have to weigh two goods, two bads. Don't ask me. You know, in effect, you decide. And that's the halakha, in fact. The halakha is you decide. You have to weigh these issues because this is not a clear-cut issue. You have to weigh two things that are in conflicting with one another, and wherever you go, we respect the decision that you make.
Why didn't the editor put the earlier story where Rabbi Yochanan said, happy is the person who knows him? As Rav Asi left and said to himself, oi, happy is
that? No, I think it's maybe the right order. Yeah. It's in the right order here. Because we want to finally get to a case, which is this case, which is the most difficult case. Or maybe it's not such a difficult case.
Most difficult because this is intimating that there's something unhealthy about her.
Her behavior, right.
Behavior that she wants someone as handsome as him, meaning
right.
Like him,
right.
Like him.
Right. She's making advances to him in a way, which is not appropriate. Okay. Amar le'eni yodea. Atrach porta hadar ata. He waited a while, and then he went back to Rabbi Yochanan. So he goes back to Yochanan again. Amar le, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, Asi nitratzet letzet. I guess you want to go. Alright. So here the rabbi is just trying, he's not telling him what to do. He's already told him to do what he wants to do. But he's gathering from his persistence that he would feel better if he went than if he didn't go. And that's the nature of guilt in those things, you know. At a certain point, it would make him feel better. And then he says, Hamakom yachsircha leshalom. May God return you in peace. In other words, if you want to go, go. But may you come back quickly. May you come back quickly. Atala kameder Rabbi Elazar. Rav Asi then comes before Rabbi Elazar. Amale. And Rav Asi says to Rabbi Elazar, Chas v'shalom dilma mirtach ratach. Maybe he was angry at me. He's afraid that Rabbi Yochanan finally gives in to him, and really he was angry, and that's why he let him go. Right? He felt guilty that maybe he had said something wrong to the rabbi. Amale maya malach. So Rabbi Elazar says to him, what did he say to you? Amar le amakom yachzircha leshalom. May God return you in peace. Amar le, Rabbi Elazar says to Rav Asi, im ita deratach lo hava mevarech lach. If he were angry at you, he wouldn't have blessed you. He gave you a blessing, in fact. And if he were really mad at you, he wouldn't have said that. He wouldn't have said that. Okay? So it takes a weight off him. At the end of the story is Abba Hachi Vahachi Shama La Arona De Ka'ate. Meanwhile, Rav Asi heard that his mother's coffin was approaching. So in other words, either he got the story wrong in the first place, or on the way she died. And we don't know. Okay? And then he says, kind of startling reaction, Amar iyade de la nafke. If I had known that she was dead, I wouldn't have gone out. Now, for us, that's kind of surprising. So you would assume that if he knew his dead mother was out there, he should have gone take care of her. But I think the purpose of this here is to say the real issue is before she dies. The real issue is before she dies, not after she dies. There was, in fact, a conflict here of leaving the land of Israel. And Rabbi Yochanan was very clear that in most cases you're not allowed to do that. Indeed, to honor a living parent, to honor a living parent, which is an honor that only you can do, only a child can do that, only a child is the mitzvah of honoring a living parent, in that case, we say, do as you please. You know, even in this tough case of the demented parent. But in the case of the dead parent, in fact, that honor is no longer the same. Anybody can take care of that. We will then go, you're going to see very shortly, we're going to move to, well, what should you be doing for a dead parent? What conveys honor to a dead parent? Because it's not as if, even once the parent dies, that honor disappears. It's not the case. So don't think that that's the point of the story. But where there was a balance between two rights, namely a right to honor the parent and a right to stay in the land of Israel, that we could not decide between. Once we have a parent who is no longer living, then the balance falls toward the land of Israel here. Okay?
Where would he have gone in terms of what other Jewish communities besides maybe Babylonia?
Well, it was from Babylonia. And so it's either to Babylonia, which is a big place.
But she followed him from there.
But we don't know what that means. You know, she could still have been in Babylonia, or somewhere between Babylonia and the land of Israel.
The assumption was he would have gone back there.
Correct. Correct.
Is the implication that you should honor your parents no matter what their behavior? I mean, we could think of, you know, someone could be a criminal or frankly, Madoff, whose son, seriously, his son turned him in. Was that...
That's going to be an interesting story.
Yeah, but you have a joint decision.
I don't know that I know what the... I don't know the facts of that story yet, and...
Don't believe everything you read.
Yeah, let's see...
Is there a time not that the parent is not worthy of child's honor?
Well, we'll see cases where the child has some difficulty in doing certain things, and of course you've got to do your best, in effect. But the force of this is to say that it's to recognize that sometimes your best may not seem like enough, but in fact it's the best that you can do. And we're willing to accept that. I wanted to read to you here Maimonides on the subject. Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah has a section which is called Hilchot Mamrim. These are people who go against rabbinic law. This is toward the end of the Mishneh Torah. Chapter 6, Halacha Yud. He codifies the following. Mi shenitrafa da'ato shel aviv o shel imo. A person whose parent, whose mother or father is crazy, is demented. Nitrafa da'ato. It's the same in modern Hebrew. You say the same thing. Literally, his mind is torn apart. Mind is torn apart. Shel aviv v'shel imo. Okay? Either the mother or the father. Mishtadel linhog imahem kafi da'atam. He should try as much as possible to get along with them, even the way their mind is. Ad shiruchem aleihem. Until mercy will come from heaven. There are two ways that mercy can come. Either they'll get better or they'll die. All right. So one should try to tolerate whatever is possible. This is what's crucial. Ve'im e'ef sharlo la'amod mipnei shenishtatu biyoter. If it is impossible for him, la'amod, to stand up, in other words, to deal with this. It's impossible for him to deal with it. Mitnation nishtatu biyoter, because they have really gone way off the deep end. Yanichem, should leave them with someone else. Vielechlo, and he should go away. V'yitzaveh acherim lahanhigam kara'ui lahem. And he shall command other people to treat them in a way that is appropriate for them.
That feels like a case that does the wrong thing.
It's an incredible law. This comes out of our Talmud that we just read. This comes out of the Talmud. What?
It's a nursing home.
Exactly. Well, if we're in the extreme case. In the extreme case.
Is that for any child, a male or a female?
Correct. Correct. It's a case for all children and all parents. So this is the law according to Maimonides. Now, in the commentaries on Maimonides here, it's fascinating because the Rabbad is one, it was from South France. And the Rabbad writes the following: Mishenitra fadato shel aviv. He quotes Maimonides. Yanechem vielech liovitzavem acherim laanikam karaui. That's just what I read to you. The Rabbad says the following: Efshar. What Maimonides says is impossible. Ein zo hora'a. We are not to teach this. He says this about Maimonides. Ein zo hora'a nechona. This is not the correct teaching. Im hu yelech v'yaniach lo l'mishi yitzaveh l'shomro, that a person should leave his parent at the hand of somebody who should take care of him. Okay? All the commentators quote this, the objection of the Rabbad, and they reject the Rabbad because of what the Talmud says in the story that we just read.
There's no explanation for that objection?
No.
Don't do that.
He says it's just wrong, and he gives no sources for it. And all the commentators support Maimonides' conclusion, because Maimonides' conclusion is obvious, it's based on the Talmud. And the Rabbad brings no sources. I assume what is going on here is that the Rabbad is reflecting an ambivalence that all of us have.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that probably in South France, in the area of where he was, he wanted to discourage people from doing this, lest they follow the dictates of Maimonides. I think we read this and we say, very wise, very thoughtful, you know, this is a good way to balance a very, very difficult problem. In this case, you're allowed to leave and to put someone else in your place who in fact can do better than you can in the circumstances, because that person is not as upset by it as you are.
But maybe to include the objection is to say, but don't do it so quickly.
Yeah, well, maybe that's right. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's its function here, because he doesn't say that, he doesn't use the normal language here. He doesn't say, this is not halacha. He says, ze lo hora'a nechona. It's not a correct teaching. It's an odd way to phrase it.
The Rambam, this last word that ended with "and he should go," is there a suggestion there that the son, after leaving the parents, must relocate? Because it didn't begin with that he wanted to go somewhere. It was just about whether he was taken care of.
I think he's using the story that we read and putting it into just more general language. Yelech lo. Now, yelech lo can mean next door. Yeah, I mean, it could be next door. It could mean you go to your job. Or it could mean that you go to the land of Israel from Babylonia. It could mean any of those things.
I didn't know if there was a suggestion that there's somebody has to embarrassment entailed on behalf of the parents.
I see. So you have to go far enough away. So, yeah. No, I don't think so.
There's another dimension to it other than protecting the child from being in the crosshairs here. And that's the, I think, well-recognized possibility that the demented parent would actually do better with someone who would look for taking care of them.
Mm-hmm.
That would be less a motive and might actually help to calm a demented parent, not to have the psychological
absolutely correct
from that. So there could be that component.
Yes.
Based on he was a physician.
Yeah. No, that's very important. That's the other side. Exactly.
Right.
Very, very important. Mary, you were going to say?
Well, actually, I was thinking the other way around, but maybe that's the more correct approach. What it seems to me that what Maimonides is saying there is not right, because if the parents are so difficult, and they abuse you, and there are chances that you would abuse them, put them in the care of strangers, they might be get even more abused. Whereas you can, you still have the obligation to respect, whereas strangers don't necessarily have that.
These are very difficult questions, and very difficult. Sometimes you have to weigh many of these issues that you're bringing up, really, in order to do what's right.
It's also something about the degree. I mean, if you're saying abusive is one thing. If somebody's truly mentally disturbed, that's a whole different category. Mm-hmm.
You lose your patience, you can get abusive verbally or otherwise, and to prevent that, you walk away. But strangers might even be even less tolerant to that.
That's what my Israeli neighbors say. That's why God created Filipinos.
In Israel,
In Israel, all of these cases are dealt with by people from the Philippines. And here too? In Israel, it's all, it's, you say in Hebrew, Filipino, Yeshel Filipino. Say, legal or illegal Filipino, right? That's the way you talk about it in modern Hebrew. Oh, sure, the Hebrew speaking Filipinos. And,
My parents,
there you go. You had the experience. You had the
some of them were legal, some of them came.
Cookie or no cookie, exactly.
Most
of them are Catholics.
Whatever, I tell you, a lot of Catholics who are not Filipinos, I mean, who don't know how to do this, and people have explained to me, you know, the theories, why are Filipinos able to do this, you know, what is the education of the culture, I don't know, but obviously there's something in the culture that makes them very suited to do things that many other cultures find extremely difficult.
But when my mother was writing this, I don't know who was going to come and care for people, because we talked about family kind of thing.
Right.
So I don't really know whether they were paid or exactly what the situation is. So I think it's quite remarkable that he talks about this in a different kind of social and job structure.
Absolutely. To be continued in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you.